Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Lamont Banks. How's everyone doing?
Doing good.
Great.
Doing good.
Everybody sure? Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. 8976. We got a good program lined up for you this evening. We're going to do our got a current event, but then we're also going to change the format just a little bit and highlight some things regarding the IRP 6 case that you may have never heard about. And we're going to dedicate some time to that, and you can look forward to that from show to show. And so this evening, we're going to pick out some things related to the analysis that retired federal judge H. Lee Sarikin did regarding this case and some of the things that contributed to this wrongful conviction and things that should be considered for exoneration for the IRP 6. But before we get too far, Lisa, let's have the disclaimer.
Yes, we want to inform you all that we are not attorneys and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. And also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening.
And then also, before we even get going even further, you know, we have the petition, and we'll talk a little bit more about the IRP 6, but we always want to bring this up front so that folks can go out and look up these petitions, make phone calls to your friends and family, ask them to get involved. And it's a petition that pertains to when the Fifth Amendment of the IRP 6 was violated during the case, where Judge Arguello compelled them to take the stand, and the transcript associated with that has never been delivered to the IRP 6 or their attorneys or a Just Cause. And we'll dive deeper into that in our discussion later on. But as far as a petition to compel the courts to deliver that, what do we have going there, Lisa?
Okay, well, we've currently got two petitions out there. We've got one on change.org. We've got one also on moveon.org. If you go out there, we are asking people to go out to those two websites, and we want you to search IRP 6. And sign those two petitions. We want you to tell your friends, tell your family, tell your coworkers, anybody who you can get to go out there. We need your support. These petitions are requesting that the Department of Justice and Congress investigate and force Judge Christine Arguello to release the missing sidebar that shows the Fifth Amendment violation that would exonerate the IRP 6 men.
Absolutely. And we want to be sure that you keep the IRP 6 in prayer. That's David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. And so we just want to be sure that you keep them in your prayers. And then also, for more information about the IRP 6, go to change.org. Again, change.org. And be sure to look up any information that you might need to find out about that. Again, oh, you already talked about that, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I'm sorry. I meant to say freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org for any information, and you can find out more information about the IRP 6. Now, a couple of things that we're going to be talking about this evening, we're going to be talking about privatization of the courts, privatization of the prison system.
Yes.
And I'm looking at this picture of Thurgood Marshall. That's why I said that. And we got some stunning news associated with that that we're going to bring out a little bit later. And everyone knows who Thurgood Marshall is. And so we'll bring that up a little bit later as well. And then also we got joining us on that subject is going to be Arnie Alpert. And so we're looking forward to that coming up in the second half of the program. As far as current news is concerned, Cliff, what do we have as far as current news?
Well, I was looking at this article. You know, we have the several articles. The one about Thurgood Marshall Jr. Is just pretty much appalling to me. You know, this program is about the privatizations of prisons in America. And this article came out in May of 2013, where it was found that Thurgood Marshall Jr., who is the the son of the former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. He was a black Supreme Court justice, and he was best known for his victory in Brown versus Board of Education. His son sits on the board of directors for the Corrections Corporation of America, commonly known as CCA. And for those who don't know, you know, we've talked about CCA here before, but they're the largest private prison-owning company in the United States. And Thurgood Marshall Jr., as a black man, to be sitting on the board of directors of that corporation is not only shocking and disturbing, but very troubling. We look at, you know, some of the words of Michelle Alexander, who is she's the author of The New Jim Crow. And she said, today there are more African Americans under correctional control in prison or jail on probation or parole than there were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. There are millions of African Americans now cycling in and out of prisons and jails or under correctional control. And CCA has had so much success, this article says, that in 2012, they sent proposal letters to prison officials in 48 states offering to purchase and manage public prisons at a substantial cost savings to the states. In exchange for their purchase, the proposal states that the prison must include 1,000 beds and states must agree to maintain a 90% occupancy rate in the privately run prisons for the term of the contract, which is 20 years. And even the author of this article says, how does one ensure a 90% occupancy rate for 20 years? How is this ethical? Who will be among 90%? Looking at the current laws that increase our prison population, the laws that ensure occupancy rate, the three strikes law, and our failed war on drugs and unjust sentencing, we can ascertain that a large percent of that occupancy rate will consist of black men. So Thurgood Marshall Jr., shame on you. I thought that it would be good to bring it to the attention of the public that the son of a Supreme Court justice, the Honorable Thurgood Marshall, who fought
for civil rights.
I mean, everybody who knows anything about civil rights knows about Brown versus Board of Education. How does his son watch what he did and watch the good that he did and then sit on the board of directors of Corrections Corporation of America? Yes, this is the same company that, the large financial institutions here in America, you know, have over a million shares of their stock. They are basically the ones that have the privatized prisons and ensure that people continue to be locked up, innocent, guilty, whatever it is. They are looking to make sure that there's a 90% occupancy rate for 20 years, and they got that as a guarantee from the states. That is atrocious, and
wow.
I think we should all continue to fight against that. I know we here at AJC Radio will continue to do what we must to bring light to things like this.
Absolutely. And moving on to the IRP 6 case, one of the things that we often highlight is the fact that the IRP6 were very instrumental in, they actually started a just cause. And so we have to spend time talking about that case, because as that case unfolded, the IRP6 realized that what was happening to them as far as the injustice, and they initially wanted to draw attention to their case, but once they got into it deeper, they realized that this was not just happening to them, but it was happening to other people. And so they wanted to have a vehicle whereby they could get information out to the public regarding judicial injustice. And so that's where the IRP6 come into play with a just cause. But to give you some background on the case, this is a case where in 2003 you have the IRP6. They started the company IRP Solutions, developing software for state, federal, and local law enforcement. Now, this software was designed to help law enforcement do investigations. It was to help them automate that process because it was a very paper-driven process up to that time. Also, you have to recognize the fact that 9/11 had just occurred. And with 9/11, the 9/11 Commission stated that the one of the problems was the fact that law enforcement at all levels, maybe one agency had some information, another one had another piece of information, but they were not sharing information. They were not collaborating on the information that they had. And so the 9/11 Commission says that that contributed to the events that occurred on 9/11. The Department of Homeland Security was set up. IRP Solutions was already working on this software. IRP Solutions was contacted by the Department of Homeland Security and said, you know, we understand that you guys are developing something that we need to see. And that was the SILC software, the Case Investigative Lifecycle software. Now, with this software, it would allow the agencies to do that. In working with the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security kept making requests and saying, can you guys make modifications? Can you tweak it here? Can you put a federal face on it? Can you do this and can you do that? Well, IRP Solutions wanted to, you know, it's like a small business catching a big fish, especially when you are contacted by the federal government. So in order to accommodate that, they engaged staffing companies in order to get the right type of talent in order to finish out this software. Now, you know, Cliff, anybody who is in small business knows that, okay, you're going to go in debt. And so IRP Solutions got accused of wrongdoing all because of debt. The company was raided in 2005, and then that's when the injustice just unfolded, one after the other. Starting off with the FBI raid, the way that things happened there, the case, the guys ended up getting indicted. In 2011, the case went to trial. Now, and I'm coming up to you, Lamont, as far as the discussion on pro se, because a lot of times the question comes up as to, well, when the guys went to trial, why did they represent themselves pro se? And I know, Lamont, you've and Lamont Banks is our special contributing analyst, and he's done a lot of research on the subject of pro se litigation. And so, Lamont, what have you found out about this?
Well, what we find and we continually find in this particular situation, and going to Cliff's point with Thurgood Marshall, I pulled an article from the New York Law Journal, and it goes to really the reason why pro se and information should be allowed to people and the opportunity to defend themselves. He says here, from the days when he was a library clerk at Howard University School of Law to the time when he authored the majority opinion in Bounds, Justice Thurgood Marshall was eminently conscious of what was not only within the library but was left out of the library. This institution should serve him well as a civil rights litigator, Supreme Court justice. In his book Bounds, Marshall hinted that even the services of a court-appointed lawyer may be inadequate without the backup of library and information. He foresaw that both were necessary, effective representation and an informed client. So when we go to the fact that attorneys are overworked, as we talked before, their caseload is too much. They don't have the capability to give due process to their clients. The Honorable Thurgood Marshall saw this as being that there's the fact back then that we were looking at ineffective counsel. This goes to the point that if a lawyer cannot defend me properly, then I have no other choice but to defend myself and do the research. Mm-hmm. And he gave the opinion that that people have the intelligence to through due process and research to represent themselves if necessary. And he felt that back then it was that the court-appointed attorney system that's in place in this country is completely inadequate. And so the IRP6 took a position based upon what they felt, not only from an assumption, but what they saw. An attorney does not fail to go see their client for almost a year, I believe it was, Cliff, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And gave no information. Mm-hmm. Gave no strategy of defense, and you wait an entire year, and you want me to entrust my life in your hands with a 10-minute meeting saying we're headed to court tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's a huge issue, but one that speaks even louder to that is here you have these six attorneys, these court-appointed attorneys for the IRP6, and you have Discovery, which was somewhere in the order of 18,000 pages. A lot of it was, you know, fluff, a lot of bank records, things of that nature that really didn't have any bearing on the case or really any evidence. But for the attorneys not to have looked at any of that discovery, not to have gone through any of the evidence, not to have interviewed one witness, what would you, as a defendant, what would you do? What would you have these defendants to do to say, I am understanding that this is a person here that is not fighting for me. My best interest is not at heart to them. They could care less what happens. All they want is for me to agree to a plea deal when I've committed no crime. Any reasonable person would say, look, this person is not fighting for me. Yeah. I need to get rid of them.
Well, the question is, if you're looking at, you said 18,000 pages of discovery.
Right.
Now, if that is the case, which that's the case here with the RP6, what is placed upon the burden of the judge is the judge at that time, when those attorneys failed to do what they needed to do,
mm-hmm.
had the power to throw the case completely out.
Right.
She had the power to do that because that is a motion which is ineffective counsel, which is a 35C motion that you file with the court for ineffective counsel. But that is usually not allowed until post-conviction relief after
right.
the appellate process is done. However, that blatant act by those attorneys should have been, and that's what the judge is there to do, to say, wait a minute, you brought these men to court, you haven't read one page of discovery, you have not represented them well at this point as the referee of proceedings. I am throwing this case out because you failed to make due process at that point has been violated. But Judge Arguello refused to act in the role that she took an oath to do.
Right.
Well, that's the job of a credible judge.
Absolutely.
Oh, no kidding. And check this out. I think this is gonna floor you, Cliff and Lamont. I've been looking for this information and just found it. On federal cases, the rate now and what I'm going to talk about here, Lamont, is the motivation for a litigant to go pro se, because there is absolutely no motivation for an attorney to go to represent as a court appointed attorney, except for the fact, like you say, Lamont, they have a caseload, they have cases piled upon top of cases upon top of cases. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the UnitedStatesCourts.gov, they actually have the rate posted out there. For federal cases, non-capital, attorneys get a rate of $126 per hour. $126 per hour. Now, that's not a shabby rate, right? For a capital case, they get $180 per hour. Now, here's the kicker. There is a limit on felony cases.
Right.
$9,800.
Yeah.
How much work does that get to? 77 hours. That's less. If they put full-time work toward your case, that's less than 2 weeks.
Right. And that's where they stop. They say, look, you know, hey, I'm getting paid less than $10,000.
Why should they care?
And most attorneys are saying that's not even my retainer. And so it's like, I don't care. I'm not reviewing any discovery. I'm not doing any witness interviews. All I'm going to do is try to get you to sign this plea deal so I can get my $9,500 and move along, which is sick. That's why the entire judicial system in the U.S., it needs to be revamped. I mean, you have this compounded on top of all the other issues, but that is how the prosecutors get their 98% conviction rate.
Absolutely.
Because the defense attorneys are saying, just give me a plea.
Why am I going to waste my time?
Let's move on. It's sick.
And it proves Lamont's case from the standpoint that you got a better shot at it yourself, because
right.
you're gonna buckle down. You're gonna do the homework. You're gonna dig deep, and you're gonna try and find out all the information you can to shoot this case, to shoot as many holes in this case as you can. Let's come back and talk about this a little bit more, Lamont, because I know you got a little bit more information. Let's talk a little bit more about this after this quick break. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We'll be right back.
Odds of becoming an astronaut, 1 in 13,200,000. Odds of being struck by lightning, 1 in 576,000. Odds of dating a supermodel, 1 in 88,000. Odds of bowling a perfect game, 1 in 11,500. Odds of being trapped in an elevator, 1 in 24,528. Odds of catching a ball at a major league game, 1 in 563. Odds of an injury from shaving, 1 in 6,585. Odds of tripping while texting, 1 in 10. Odds of getting cancer in your lifetime, 1 in 2 men, 1 in 3 women.
It's up to us
to change the odds for our generation.
For the ones we love.
For our future.
If you don't like the odds, stand up. Stand up to cancer.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness
are all courtesy of the heroic men and women of the United States military.
They give so much, and they ask so little.
I'm Joe Bontaine.
I'm Jack Scalia.
I'm Nick Searcy.
I'm Bonnie Jo Laughlin.
I'm Scott Elrod. Please help me thank our heroes by doing something.
Donate your time, talent, or gifts
to groups and organizations devoted to our troops and their families.
Visit a veteran's hospital.
A smile. A hug,
a shoulder, a handshake,
or even an attentive ear goes a long, long way.
Quite simply, give.
They'll sincerely appreciate it.
And it just might do wonders for you, too.
Remember, freedom isn't free.
Freedom isn't free.
Freedom isn't freedom. Free. Get involved.
Give back now.
God bless America.
God bless America.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect. But together, we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to innocenceproject.org to make a donation and get involved.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
To A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Lamont Banks. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976. Lamont, during the break, you were sharing some more information with us regarding the court process, proceedings, and then the rationale for someone to go pro se.
Yeah, and we were talking about, in most cases, if and this goes to the speedy trial issue, which was another violation by Judge Christine Arguello, who violated that process as well for the RFP6, where, and this is what doesn't make any sense to me, in the case when the prosecution is not ready to proceed and the judge has given them time to get their case together to go ahead and present at trial, if the prosecution is not prepared to go forward, the case is dismissed with prejudice, which means they can, and you can have overwhelming evidence in a case against somebody, but if you are not prepared to go forward and you haven't done your due diligence, as a lot of judges call it, to be prepared for trial, the judge at that point will dismiss the case with prejudice, which means the state can no longer bring those charges against that particular defendant. Somebody help me understand then. That if, and it looks like here in this case with the RP6, that the violation of due process was violated from the beginning as a result of these attorneys. And if the RP6 felt compelled or forced to go pro se, well, that's a violation of law because now they have been intimidated and they have been, if you will, they have been coerced through action and failure of action by their attorneys. If I feel like, well, I have to, the point of pro se is that I have a choice to go pro se.
Right.
If I choose to, I can choose an attorney and I can choose, or I can choose myself. In the IRP 6 case, these men were forced to go pro se because their attorneys failed to uphold the oath they took to represent them and uphold the Constitution and to ensure that due process was carried out. So what you have here, in my, from what you can see very, very clearly, and it, again, it goes to the corruption level of this federal judge, Christina Aguayo, who failed to act. People think, well, if the judge did this or did that, then they are at fault. They are just as guilty if they fail to act.
Right.
The judge failed to act in this case. So if I feel like I'm coerced or I am pushed or I am forced, they'll say to you, the judge will give instruction to the defendant if he chooses to even testify. There's very cautious, very careful information given to that defendant. Are you sure this is something that you want to do? Were you coerced? Did your attorney tell you you had to testify or that you didn't have to testify? Are you sure? Are you on the influence of any drugs or any alcohol that is influencing your decision? This is protocol. Judge Aguayo failed.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well,
she has to be held accountable for that.
And when you look at, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, why would they go pro se? But then on the other side of that coin, people ask, well, why did they have court-appointed attorneys in the first place? Why didn't they hire an attorney? And you have to, you know, we have to go back and say that, you know, everybody who's been listening to anything about the IRP 6 case, you have six IT professionals who, you know, decided to go into business as entrepreneurs to develop this software, like Sam talked about a little bit earlier, to help out the federal law enforcement. Well, when it came down to it and the company got raided, you know, basically, the FBI began to tell, you know, DHS, which was a potential client of IRP Solutions, they told DHS, don't have any communications with IRP Solutions. These men are under investigation. You can't talk to them. So there goes a client that you've given a quote to for $100 million for one portion of your product, which was the Silk software that they were trying to sell. Same thing happened with the other federal agencies that were potential clients, you know, Philadelphia PD, NYPD, these large law enforcement agencies. Well, in the meantime, when these men go back to the workforce to say, hey, you know, I was a nicely paid consultant in the IT industry, everywhere they went to try to get a job, they were being blackballed by the federal government. When I say federal government, I'll say Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, because when at Philadelphia PD, Matthew Kirsch was in touch with them as a client and told them, hey, there's going to be an indictment coming down on the IRP 6, so you need not do any business with them. Well, that's an interference in commerce. You have other places that they went to work that where the FBI would show up. The FBI showed up at Gary Walker's job at Kaiser Permanente. I remember working with Dave Zerpolo and Demetrius Harper, two more of the IRP 6, and we were all working at the same company. And that was during the time that the FBI was passing around this article that had been sent out by these, you know, the article had been written and the FBI was passing it around to these staffing companies. Well, I remember their staffing company come in and walking them off the job. I mean, basically just firing them right there. I mean, this isn't evidence of any wrongdoing. This is an accusation. They're under investigation by the federal government, but they get walked off of their job. So everywhere they went, they had been getting blackballed in the industry. So when they would try to get a job, the agencies, the staffing companies, the different places, the clients that they would try to work at would say, no, you know, we've seen your name in the industry. We have this article that's been passed around, so we aren't going to hire you. Well, they're reasonable. You know, expectation of getting a job there, the way that they paid bills, the way that they got, that they made money. I mean, they could not get work.
Hey, Cliff, can I interject right
sure,
there?
Sure, go ahead.
Because on that point of the FBI as well as Susan Holland and whoever else was instrumental in publishing an article or blackballing the guys online through the staffing industry websites, through the staffing industry professional networks, mm-hmm. and specifically naming them, that is so out of – that is not even the norm. And as you look at, you know, we've talked to several staffing company professionals, like Andrew Alberelli,
right.
the owner of Remy Corporation. And, you know, the staffing industry professionals that we've talked to, they say, yeah, internally – they have codes in their system that could say, okay, for this particular person, they may code that person as a do not hire or whatever. They're, you know, poor performer or whatever the reason might be. They may code that person, and if their resume comes through again, they may say, you know, it's going to be a long stretch before we use that person again.
Right.
But never do they see where an individual or a group of people are called out by name online by an entire industry to say, don't use them. And this happened before there was even a trial.
Right, absolutely. Well,
there was not a trial. I mean, no one had been convicted of anything.
This was pre-indictment.
Pre-indictment.
Well, what the FBI did, Sam, there, they stepped out of the role of what they are supposed to do, which is misconduct. You cannot go to people and say there's an indictment pending against a defendant.
Absolutely.
At least according to the law, you can't do that. Your job as the FBI is to investigate, and until a conclusion has been brought to the matter, you are bound. You can't do that. So it's like, well, what do you do? These people, the FBI, and again, when you look at everything that's going on with the RP6 case from the very beginning, as you sit here and discuss what steps were taken, when the prosecution stepped out of the role of prosecutor and began to – it becomes personal now. The FBI stepped out of the role of protocol. It becomes personal now. Well, that's prejudice and it's bias and it's a violation of law. These issues cannot go undealt with. Because at the end of the day, you got so much misconduct here and so much of it to go around from the beginning to the end, from the appellate court to Judge Arguello, from every possible to the ineffective attorneys here. How can you possibly sit on any bench in this country, appellate or otherwise, and sit back and say, we affirm? We have no problem with it. Something is drastically wrong with the system.
And, Lamont, I want to go back to one point that you were making even about the speedy trial. And yeah. I know, Cliff, you want to get back to the part about the blackballing and some of the things that contributed to it. But one of the points you had made, Lamont, about the speedy trial, and as you're talking about ineffective counsel, and we talked about the motivation or the demotivation of attorneys taking cases. I mean, sure. You know, there's a limitation on what they can take. Well, the IRP6 were actually penalized, and this is just me talking, you know, but if you look at it from the standpoint, from a speedy trial perspective, at the time that the court-appointed attorneys were on board, they requested a continuance, and then they requested another continuance, and then they requested another continuance under the auspice that they needed to review discovery. Now, we've already talked about the fact that they didn't do that, but they say they needed to. So then you get to trial, the speedy trial has been violated, it becomes a point of appeal, and then the Court of Appeals ignores it and says that, no, there was no speedy trial violation. Well, they penalized the guys for the actions of the court-appointed attorneys, right. And the court-appointed attorneys basically jumped ship. I mean, they got fired, but they were held accountable, the IRP6 were held accountable for the actions of these attorneys.
Well, the problem is with that is that anytime there's a this is what is so insane about this process. Anytime speedy is waived and you seek a continuance, that is at the behest of the client. You must say to your client, we are asking for a continuance. Do you agree? The judge will ask the defendant, are you okay? Have you discussed, and ask the attorneys, have you discussed this continuance with your client, and have they agreed to waive speedy? That is not the position of the attorneys. I, as a client, must waive speedy. And the judge has to make me aware of that. So the fact that, Judge Aguello said nothing and they've assumed – you can't waive a guy's speedy trial as his attorney and say we need time for more discovery. That is the decision of the defendant, which in this case is the IRP 6. And the bottom line is, had they not waived speedy, at least the crookedness that they're trying to say the IRP 6 did – that's right there what the attorneys did there in waiving speedy without consulting with their client is violation of law. It's violation of due process. It is violation of speedy. And again, the judge has failed to act. How many other things do you need to come together to see the nonsense of this situation? It is completely ludicrous.
That's right. And I mean, there's so many arms of corruption and the law being just thrown in the street on this by Judge Arguello. I mean, you got and instead of the attorneys acting and doing anything, all they kept doing was doing continuances. And like you said, Lamont, that's where the judge should have stepped in and said, wait a minute. You're telling me you as attorneys are continuing to request these continuances on this case, and your client does not have a problem with that. Have the judge at that time,
absolutely,
instead of saying which what Judge Arguello did, well, it's in the interest of justice. Instead of her saying your client has no problem with you waiving his speedy trial act, because we're far past the 70. I mean, the Speedy Trial Act was violated by over 100 days in the IRP 6
and case. The case would have had to be dismissed.
Absolutely.
I've seen it personally. A guy dressed in his clothes to go to trial. The judge says, is the prosecution ready to proceed? Your Honor, we need another day. Case dismissed.
And that is when the judge is on top of what's going on.
Absolutely.
And looking for justice.
That's
if
the
your
line.
If your rights are violated, your trial should be the charges against you should be dismissed. But to go back to what I was talking about earlier with the men being blackballed, we have a copy of a resume of Demetrius Harper, who was one of the IRP 6. This resume was sent to Comcast while he was a contractor, a consultant. He was looking for work, you know, while all this was going on. And see, sometimes people don't believe it. Like, they weren't blackballed. You know, that's just something you guys are saying. They just couldn't get work and
right.
Decided to get pro se defense. Well, we have a copy of Demetrius Harper's resume from Comcast with the hiring manager's notes on it.
Yeah.
On this resume, it says no in capital letters, and it's underlined. It says source, Colorado Springs newspaper, and then on the side, it says arrested for money fraud. Now, Demetrius was never arrested.
Never.
But when they say source, Colorado Springs newspaper, that is the article that these staffing companies was passing around, that the FBI, rather, was passing around to these staffing companies, that, hey, these men are under investigation, these are the things that they did, like they were already convicted, like they had already been not only indicted, but convicted, arrested for money fraud, put on his resume, and passed around Comcast when he's a consultant trying to make money.
And actually, Cliff, there was another Demetrius Harper that was in the news at that time who had been convicted.
Right.
Me and Demetrius had talked about that. It's like there was a Demetrius Harper who was part of some crazy ring in Denver, Colorado, and he was convicted. And I believe the only difference was that there was the middle initial.
Mm.
And
yeah.
So, but still, you know, there in the IRP 6 case, there had not been, and like you said, Cliff, not even an
right.
indictment.
This is just an investigation. And for when they're citing the Colorado Springs newspaper, I mean, that was the paper that had this article that the staffing companies was
yes.
passing around and saying, hey, these men, you know, they're under investigation. This is what they've done. That is, I mean, anybody can put anything they want. I can take out an article right now and say that Lisa Stewart was convicted of murdering 12 people yesterday. I can put that as an ad in the newspaper. Sure, she could sue me for slander,
yes,
but I could still take out that ad. And so here you have this article written by these staffing companies
with this information in it. And it's like, but where is the proof? Where actually is the trial that went on? All they're saying is, oh, this is what they did. They scammed these companies. And it's a total untruth written in an article, and it's being passed around the staffing industry. And gratefully, you know, when it got to Andrew Albarelli's desk, he said, no, this stops here.
Yep.
This is not fair. This has been, you know, I was talking to him about this a couple of weeks ago. He said he had seen all of the hands that had gone through, and when it got to his desk, he said, no, we need to ask some questions and see what's going on before we pass this to somebody else. How do we know that this is true? And that's when, you know, Kelly Balcom called me up. And we went up and talked to him. And, you know, the rest of the story is what it is, that, you know, he was going to be an expert witness for the IRP 6. And ironically, but not ironically, crookedly, Judge Arguello would not let him testify because why? He was going to tell the truth about what happened. But you see all these things. You see these men getting blackballed, and then people question, well, why would they go pro se? Well, you're blackballed. You can't make money. You can't make a living. And then you get some attorneys that are appointed by the court, and these attorneys are doing absolutely nothing for you. We have a caller on the line that wants to make a comment about this situation. Tanique, go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
Did we lose her?
Can you hear me, Cliff?
Yes,
hello?
We hear you.
Can you
go
hear
ahead.
Me? I apologize for that. I just wanted to call and chime in. As you said, when you're talking about Demetrius Harper resume, I actually worked for Comcast. I was there for almost 3 years. I'm one of the top performers in recruitment. And when you say these guys' names were blackballed, you're exactly right. I remember when Demetrius was a contractor for Comcast, Kendra Barnes was a contractor for Comcast, and Kendra Barnes had actually been offered a full-time position at Comcast. And when this situation happened, you're exactly right. They were sending resumes around the company saying that the guys were criminals. One of Demetrius Harper's resume actually stated on the resume, and I saw it for myself, the word felon. Well, like you said, nobody had been convicted. When you do a background check, there's a question that's asked that says, have you ever committed a crime before? Have you been convicted of a crime before? The answer is no. So no one had been convicted. So what hiring manager, what gives them the right to actually state that this person can't work there because they so-called have had this bad record? And the bottom line is that the U.S. attorney's office had called Comcast and specifically told the hiring managers not to hire IRP 6. So that's how this got out, because Comcast was not actually going out on, you know, Gazette reading papers about this whole situation. They got a phone call and were told specifically not to hire these individuals. And so I just wanted to chime in and say you're exactly right. The guys were blackballed. So how can they pay back this debt if their name's been blackballed and they can't get a job? Another thing I wanted to chime in is that we're not talking about contractors who make $5 an hour. These individuals were high-paid consultants that had made, you know, $80 and $90, up to even some of them $100 an hour. So it just makes me mad when I hear about how a company that I used to work for specifically would not hire these individuals because you know, our government was going around hiring, telling them not to hire. If I have a moment, there's something else I'd like to say, but I wanted to pause to see if you had anything that you wanted to chime in before I went to my next point.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I also worked for a company named Charles Schwab, and I, again, was an IT recruiter at this company, and same type of situation. Kendrick, I remember, had applied, very qualified for the job. I personally took his resume to one of the hiring managers who wanted to speak to Kendrick. We set up an interview, and then Sapphire Technologies, which is a consulting company in Denver, comes to my desk and gives me a handwritten piece of paper that lists the IRP 6, three of their names, saying don't hire them, they're crooks, they're criminals, and that I have already alerted the hiring manager, who in turn canceled the interview with Kendrick Barnes. And so I just wanted to, again, make reference to what you're saying. These guys were blackballed, because this is only two examples. I had heard it probably with three companies that I worked for where they were specifically told not to hire these individuals. So, you know, if the government is saying that they have a case, why are they going around town blackballing? What would make sense is let the guys get a job so they can pay back this debt, right?
Absolutely.
So it just goes to show you that they really did not have a case.
Okay, thank you very much, Tanique. And here we have, now, these are Fortune 500 companies. You're talking about Comcast. You're talking about Charles Schwab. This is one of the biggest telecom companies in the nation. This is one of the large financial investment arms of the country. How do these two companies that she just happened to work for, and you get the resumes in of the IRP6, and they both have the same story? No, we've been told by the federal government, don't hire these guys. We have this article that is basically saying, hey, these guys are criminal. You're going out of your way to blackball these men. Now, who knows how many other companies? She said she worked at three different places personally where she knew they had got blackballed, where she knew their name came up. I mean, she's in recruitment. She sits there as part of HR that says, we need to get good talent in. You get these resumes in, and in three places that you work, they're saying, no, don't hire these men. Don't hire the IRP6. None of them can get a job here. How is that, and how deep does the corruption of the federal government go?
As I sit here, okay. Comcast is the number two largest cable provider in the United States.
Yes.
Okay, so we have executives going on Capitol Hill from Comcast.
That's right.
We have high-ranking members of these corporations that give major money to campaigns. So you mean to tell me...
That's what I mean to tell you.
...that these folks... And it goes to your point, Cliff. Conspiracy?
Oh.
There's not even a thought here. How do you bring over a handwritten note?
Yeah, you have it on Demetrius's resume. You see it says felon.
Felon.
Do not hire.
He's never been convicted?
Never been tried
in the court of law. So we might as well.
Hasn't even been indicted on anything.
So we might as well throw the Constitution. We might as well shut the courts down and just throw them all in jail. That is unbelievable to me.
And, you know, I found that article. It was something published by the United States Attorney's Office in the District of Colorado in Denver, where in 2009, and the situation I was talking about earlier, where you got Demetrius L. Harper was convicted and charged on account of conspiracy and receipt of government property. Cliff, do you recall that during the IRP6 trial, like during some of the opening comments, that something was said that would allude to the fact that to the jury that at least a couple of these defendants before you.
Right. Yes, I remember.
You remember something like that?
I remember that. Like to Tanique's point, it is very simple for these agencies to run a background check.
Absolutely.
They do it all the time. They know exactly what they're doing. And actually, we have Tanique is back on the line. She has another point, Olivia is saying. So let's go ahead and hear from her again. Tanique, you had another point you wanted to make?
Yes, two points. One thing is when you're talking about the company actually doing a background. Okay, so I've been in HR for probably about 14 years, and anytime a candidate divulges information or even a hiring manager will come and say, hey, Tanique, you know, my employee committed this crime, and, can we hire them on, let's say, from a contract to a full-time? Our advice is you don't discuss that, right? That's what a background check is for. It causes us legal issues. That's how companies get sued. So we say, that's not something we encourage managers not to do it. In fact, it's actually against the law. Prime example, and here's Comcast again, I had a contractor who actually committed rape. And he raped someone, divulged that information. Hiring manager came. You can't illegally fire that person, right, because I don't have a background check stating that this person is a criminal. So for even a hiring manager to write the word arrested or even imply that somebody has a background, like, again, even if they've been convicted, you're not supposed to do that because, again, that's what a background check is for. So I just kind of – I failed to mention that, and I wanted to specify that, is that we don't even get in that. And for Comcast to hire – And just so you know, they end up hiring this individual. It was 20 years later, and guess what? The individual, while working for us at a customer's house, committed rape, and Comcast, that individual killed a female and got convicted, but Comcast got sued up the yin-yang and paid like $1 million out, yet you're now saying you don't want to hire one of the IRP6 members who hasn't been convicted of anything, but you don't want to hire him, but you go ahead and say it's okay to hire a rapist. My next comment that I wanted to make is that I was actually asked by Comcast legal team, did the U.S. Attorney's Office contact me in regards to this? And I said, why would the U.S. Attorney be contacting little old me? I'm just a recruiter that works at Comcast. Well, the reason why they were asking that statement is because I was looking for, you know, positions within the company. I do it all the time. When you work for, you go from one company to another, people contact me all the time. Hey, Tanique, where are you working? I need a job. So just as I do for everybody else, I did it for the IRP 6. Like I said, out of the six, four of them had actually worked at contract for Comcast and were in very good standing. So why would I not bring back people who had successful careers and had done a good job for us in the past? I mean, that's a walk in the cake for us as a recruiter. You want people to return who have done an excellent job for you, right? Because it makes your job easy. The hiring managers already know them. So that's why, like I said, I know that they called because I was asked about it, and then they wanted to deny them employment, even though they had no legal reason to deny them opportunity. At the time, like I said, unless you've been convicted, then there's nothing that a company can do because people have pending things all the time. And so I just wanted to, like I said, I failed to mention those two points and wanted to make sure that I made those two things clear for anybody who doesn't understand the laws in regards to HR and recruitment. Thank you.
Well, Tanique, before you go, you know, you spoke about this other guy that, you know, ended up raping a customer of Comcast. So with him already being a convict, and perhaps there were other convicts there in Comcast, what was the race, color of this individual, and if there were others there? Just from your experience, we're not, you know, just saying, hey, what Tanique said, she knew all the convicts, but just from your experience, what did you know about this individual's racial background?
He was white. And one of them who had a record for child molestation, he was Hispanic, but he was a Hispanic that looked white. I mean, I'm just being honest, you know, and so that's why, I mean, given chance. I remember the manager coming to me and saying, oh, Tanique, you know, let's give him an opportunity. He, you know, really didn't do that, but yet you don't want to give the opportunity to IRP6, and the difference is they worked for us before. This individual had never even worked for us before, but yeah, you want to put a limb on. So, you know, reach a extended branch to him. So it goes to the fact of what you guys say on the show all the time. Let's deal with the truth. It's a race issue, right? So that's what it is. Okay, if I hear that a black man or a black woman committed this crime, I'm going to go ahead and believe it without even doing the due diligence to find out if it's true or not.
Right. Okay, Tanique, we appreciate your comments, your insight. This is totally ridiculous. Go ahead, Lamont.
Cliff, I got a question. So we have names of the person who contacted these agencies, and the young lady that just called in, I presume they have the name of the person that contacted these agencies saying do not hire. Do you realize the laws that have been broken here and the formal complaints that need to be filed against that individual that you went outside of your role as United States Attorney and you purposely blackballed these six men?
That's
That is a violation of law.
That is a violation of law. That is an interference with commerce. There are so many violations here. And we know that this was Matthew Kirsch. Bottom line, we know that in hearings about this, Matthew Kirsch requested that none of this information be allowed during the trial because it happened after the raid. What that has to do with anything, I see the perplexed look on your face. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything. You broke the law.
But it has everything to do with everything.
Exactly. Well, you broke the law. You basically – now, you're talking about prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, this is major.
Right. You went outside the realms of your job and ensured that I was not able to get employment, to hire a viable legal counsel, and to be able to pay off my debt. You ensured – that I was not able to do anything except sit back and not work and not do anything so that you could basically bankrupt me, per se, quote unquote, bankrupt me and have it so that you ensure I cannot fight in court.
So here's what you have. You have court-appointed attorneys who are ineffective losers.
Right.
You have who will not represent right. You have the prosecution leaving the role of prosecutor and becomes investigator and prejudice, bias individual to blackball these six men to say, okay, we're going to give you some attorneys you will not keep, you will not use. You will be forced to go pro se. We will take every dime out of your pocket to hire private counsel.
Mm-hmm.
If that is not a clear recipe of violation of due process.
Absolutely.
If that is not clearly a violation of the Constitution of fairness to every individual, not kind of sort of let's think about it if this is happening, blatant violation of law.
That's right. And you know what makes it even worse, Lamont, is when this was brought to the attention of Judge Christine Arguello.
That's right.
She agreed with the prosecutor. Yeah, we're not going to allow anything that happened after the raid.
She's complicit.
Right, exactly. She is complicit by saying, hey, she basically gave him, hey, you have free reign. Go break whatever law you want. Go do whatever you want to do to these men to ensure that they're convicted because I will not stand up for their
And this is right. why the Department of Justice.
Yes.
Is failing to act and do their job. You want to sit back and tell us we don't have a comment about this type of conduct?
And then they want to send us back to Denver, Colorado, say, go back to Denver and talk to Judge Arguello about what
right.
he did wrong. Talk to Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch about what he did wrong. Talk to John Walsh about why he's letting his people go out as rogue idiots and fools and just corrupted in doing these type of things to the citizens of America.
Well,
and you think we as a Just Cause are not going to speak out about this?
Well, stand by.
Stand by because you got it twisted.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number, 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We'll be right back.
Each week, A Just Cause Coast to Coast shares compelling stories about judicial injustice. But AJC doesn't leave it there. AJC Radio presents top guests from across the country who are advocates, activists, attorneys, and judges who provide insight into current events and the law. If you believe in what AJC is doing, we ask that you make a donation of any amount. Your kindness will be greatly appreciated. Go to www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button. Again, please go to www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button.
The racial composition of the prison population in the United States is very different from the population at large. If people are worried about inequality in America today, I think this deserves more attention in the discussion. Racial inequality in the criminal justice system gets ignored because it doesn't affect most people. In 2010, over 1.6 million people were in state and federal prisons within the United States. So, 497 out of every 100,000 Americans were in jail. About half of 1%. Less than 1%. That doesn't seem very large, but when you separate that population by race, you recognize that the personal effects of the criminal justice system are very unequally shared throughout our society. Whites make up 64% of the total population, but only 31% of the incarcerated population. Blacks represent 14% of society, but 36% of the prison population. Hispanics are 16% of America, but 24% of the American prison population. Less than 1 in 100 Americans are currently in jail, but for some races, genders, and age groups, that ratio is a lot larger. For example, if you're young, black, and male, it's closer to about 1 in 4. That means you'd have a higher probability of going to jail than of getting married or going to college. These results are unequal and problematic, as poor black communities lack so many of their members. But what can be done? The causes of this trend are undoubtedly complicated and multi-causal. But there is reason to suggest that part of the blame is our criminal justice system itself. in the ways police officers enforce laws, in the ways that laws are written and prosecuted, and more. In many cases, it is not overt racism by individual actors. Many police officers, prosecutors, and judges are undoubtedly trying to be fair and trying to do the right thing. But economics can explain how unequal enforcement of the criminal law happens anyway. This is because the political and bureaucratic structure of the criminal justice system creates perverse incentives. The formal laws surrounding drug prohibition, for example, are written as if to be colorblind. But people with different levels of wealth face different costs and benefits to participating in the drug trade. Different groups consume different drugs at different rates, and lastly, those groups are politically represented in very different quantities. Thus, they are arrested and incarcerated at very different rates. How could minority groups hope to use the political process to fix inequality when they are systematically over-incarcerated and disenfranchised? Despite noble intentions, politics often does not affect the basic incentives of costs and benefits faced by political or citizen actors. We might need a new approach to social change if we are going to address these problems. We definitely need more study into the causes of inequality, and we should admit that radical changes might be both necessary and preferable to the status quo.
I wanted to be in the military since I was a kid.
I served in the United States Air Force.
I served a total of 16 years.
I was deployed 13 times.
On my second deployment, 4 bombs hit my vehicle.
And at 19 years old, that's the first time I ever saw somebody die.
Coming back, I was raging.
I started having pretty horrible nightmares.
I would wake up in the middle of the night, sweats.
I started drinking a lot.
I felt worthless.
I guess I never recognized it in myself.
Eventually, one day, I just walked into the VA hospital and said I'd like to see somebody.
Don't suffer alone. You got to find that link with somebody that'll make you let it go.
It all starts with going to the VA. There's a whole community of veterans that just want to help you out.
It's for the guys who couldn't come back, so you owe it to them to live well, because they're not here with their families.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Lamont Banks, Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and I'm Sam Thurman. Let's jump to our next segment. We had a lot of good information on the IRP6, and we're going to absolutely come back to that. But we're going to bring on Arnie Alpert as we talk a little bit about privatization of prisons, which is, as we all know and we've talked about before, is a major problem. And Arnie serves as the American Friends Service Committee's Economic Justice Program Analyst. Welcome to the program, Mr. Alpert. How are you doing?
It's great to be here. Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. So,
yeah.
You know, when we talk about privatization of prisons, you know, I guess in New Hampshire, you have some information as far as successful campaigns to stop the wholesale privatization of prisons. How can we make that happen across the nation as far as, you know, on a federal level?
Well, let me say that right now at the federal level, the main problem or the problem that's growing is the incarceration of immigrants. And that's the place where the growth area is and where companies like the Corrections Corporation of America and GEO are using their political connections to drive up the detention of immigrants. So certainly in this case, the fight against privatization, the fight against mass incarceration is closely tied to the fight for humane immigration policies.
Right. Now, one quick question. I was looking at your profile, and and I see where you were instrumental in getting Martin Luther King Day. You were the communications coordinator for the Martin Luther King
Day. It took us 20 years,
Yeah, but you got that passed. Now, when you look at a civil rights leader like Martin Luther King, you know, he gave his life for the cause. And then you look at, as Cliff was talking earlier, Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. And then you have Thurgood Marshall Jr. sitting on the board of CCA. What do you make of something like that?
I don't know the man, so I'm not going to make any judgments about it. But, I mean, I do think that we need to look at a legacy of justice and civil rights in this country and see that, again, this issue of private prisons is certainly antithetical to our traditions of expanding democracy, of accountability, let alone a tradition that says that we actually – if we need to have a prison system at all, it needs to be limited and it needs to be one that's oriented toward rehabilitation. And that's not what companies like CCA, that's just not their business model. Their business model is more beds, more prisoners, more cells.
And you know,
longer sentences,
And absolutely. And regardless of whether you know the man or not, and like I said, you know, when you look at the legacy of a father who gave his life, you know, for the justice system, for judicial equality, and then, you know, when you sit on a board of a company that, that, like you said, it's their business model to put heads on beds and make a profit from it. And then when you look at the racial disparity along with that, and you have studies that talk about school-to-prison pipelines, yet your dad was involved in, you know, Brown versus the Board of Education. That you got to, regardless of whether you know the man or not, there is a twisted
reality. You should get him on the show. But I guess what I'd say to that is that companies like GEO and CCA are smart. They know what they're doing. Look, today we had in the state, we had Tom Ridge, who was the governor of Pennsylvania. He was the first Secretary of Homeland Security for the federal government. Of course, Homeland Security is now in charge of immigration detention. He leaves office and he opens up a lobbying firm, and he's now the lead lobbyist for the GEO Group. So the GEO Group knows where to go to find people who are well connected. Julie Myers Wood used to be the head of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Again, it was her responsibility to detain or lock up, incarcerate immigrants. She leaves office in the public sector, she goes into the private sector, becomes a lobbyist, and now she's on the board of directors of the GEO Group. So this is the type of revolving door that we see between these companies. This is why we call this governing under the influence. Our government is making its decisions not on the basis of the public interest, but too often making its decisions on the basis of what is in the best interest of these companies that are making money off of the public and using the profits to recycle into the political system through lobbyists and through campaign contributions to keep getting what they want to feed their business model.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Howard, just to chime in, this is Lamont Banks. I was actually I was wrongfully incarcerated and actually stayed at a couple of CCA facilities. And I'll tell you what, when you make the statement that you make, and this is why our system is broken. If you're dealing with people who were former Secretary of Homeland Security, you're dealing with people who were over ICE, they have influence in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Well, with that influence in Washington, as you said, the door and the power, the balance of power there, and the power of influence, is again why the CCAs are making millions of dollars, because they know who to talk to in Washington D.C. They know who to talk to, and that is unbelievable.
Right, Lamont. There's buried in the fine print of the federal budget, there's something that's called the detention bed mandate. Right?
Sure.
It's not something that gets much discussion, but it says that basically on any given day or on an average day, there need to be 34,000 immigrants locked up in prison in the United States. Right? And, you know, and most, I think half of those I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are. I could look it up later. But a large number of those are in prisons that are operated by GO and CCA. Yeah, so it's not like in our – it's not in the debate over immigration policy. It's in the fine print. It's in the total weeds of a budget discussion.
Well,
but
it makes
it's in
sense.
There.
It makes sense to me now because the largest population in the private prisons of CCA that I attended was Hispanics and they were the prison term is paisas from Mexico.
Yeah.
They dominate the population at the CCAs. Now that as you mentioned that, as I remember, that's quite remarkable.
Yeah. Right. Just last week, a couple groups, Grassroots Leadership and Justice Strategies, put out a report called For-Profit Family Detention. You could go to either of their websites and find it. The subtitle is Meet the Private Prison Corporations Making Millions by Locking Up Refugee Families. So you've got these people, you've got women, children, families that are fleeing from intense violence in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. They're coming up to the United States, they're getting scooped up by ICE, and they're being sent to these prisons, which are kind of euphemistically called family detention centers. But it's GO and CCA, in many cases, that are running these, and they both have both companies have terrible records, which is documented in this report, for running these types of facilities. Now, I don't want to say that publicly run prisons are necessarily, lovely places for people to be. I mean, that's not the case at all. But I think that if you go through the documentation, you look at studies done by people like my colleague Carolyn Isaacs in Arizona, you find that in general, overall, conditions in the privately run prisons are worse than conditions in the publicly run prisons. And that is no doubt because the companies make a profit by skimping on things. If they don't have to invest as much in programs, if they don't have to pay the workers as much, you get higher turnover, you get people who don't care as much about their jobs, you get more violence. And this is true throughout the system, whether we're talking about county jails, whether we're talking about state prisons, whether we're talking about federal facilities.
And Mr. Alpert, I looked back to your work with Martin Luther King Day. You look at the civil rights leaders, so-called, of today, and, they are very pale, almost transparent, actually invisible compared to Dr. King and what he did. And ironically, we have a black president, we have a black BOP director, and, I know that this issue of the prison industrial complex, it has to be brought up somewhere within the realms of politics. Why is it that we don't see the civil rights entities of today fighting against the industrial complex of the prison system? Why is it that they aren't stirring things up, that they aren't making a stink about it, especially with the number of minorities that are locked up in not only state but federal prison as well? Why are we not seeing the cry come from them to get to Washington, to get up on the Hill?
Well, I think we need to – I don't want to let the rest of us off the hook on that, because I think that, again, the leaders are going to be – if they want to lead a movement and lead an upsurge, there needs to be – that insurgency needs to be there from the grassroots. So it's up to the rest of us, radio shows like this, programs of organizations like the American Friends Service Committee, and our allies that are raising these issues in communities across the country. Look at what's happening in Ferguson, where you get people who take an issue like the militarization of the police violence against the black community, and, of course, the civil rights leaders are rushing to be there at the front of the crowd if they could get there. So that'll happen once we start making a fuss at the local level. I think that can happen. And, of course, Dr. King, we remember him, of course. We remember Malcolm X. We remember Medgar Evers. But we've forgotten about the thousands, the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands, the millions of people who participated in the freedom movements in the 50s and the 60s, many of whom, putting their lives on the line to stand up for what they believed in. Nameless folks. So what we're talking about is a need to structure movements so that ordinary people are taking extraordinary action to stand up for justice and stand against the kind of injustice represented by mass incarceration, by the prison industrial complex. So I don't know. That's maybe a bit of rhetoric rather than a formula, but I think that that's what we've got to find a way to do.
No, I wouldn't call it rhetoric. I mean, that's exactly what we need to deal with. We all have to, with one voice, make a cry that says these are the things that we will not stand for. And without that, I often say, one person crying out on a hill, nobody really sees them. I mean, you don't get any attention that way. If you get 100 people up there, then people look and say, "Hey, there's a little crowd up on that hill." But you get 1,000, 250,000, 500,000, a million people crying out on top of a hill, and the whole world can hear their voice.
Right.
If
that's
it's
right.
Not, that's what we have to do as a public, is get united in this cry, in this fight against all injustices, including this prison industrial complex. There's no need, there's no way that CCA and GEO should have gotten to the place where they've gotten to be able to tell the states we want a 90% full bed ratio. That should never have been allowed. That should have been fought against from its inception. But when you have them, they claim they don't have lobbyists on Capitol Hill, that they don't lobby for laws for incarceration or prison sentencing terms. But when you have people like Thurgood Marshall Jr., I mean, he doesn't have to say anything except you put a name tag in front of him that says Thurgood Marshall Jr. and a member of board of directors of CCA. There's no other words need to be said except, will you vote CCA to have more funding or whatever? And you say yes because of his reputation. I think it is a misuse of the system and the position, especially with someone in his position and the things that his father stood for and that his father's legacy represents.
Let me tell you what we're trying to do in New Hampshire and Iowa right now. Of course, these are the states that get the best glimpses at the people who want to be president, because Iowa has the first presidential caucus and New Hampshire has the first presidential primary. This won't be until February of 2016, so 14 months from now. But we're already seeing lots of visits by people who would like to be president. So tomorrow, Mitt Romney's going to be in the state. Senator Rob Portman's going to be in the state, and this is in New Hampshire. Thursday, we're going to have a visit from Rand Paul. We've got a visit from Bill Clinton, who's leading the way for his wife, who's going to be here on November 2nd. So what we're trying to do in these two early states is get people to go interact with these folks, because you can actually do it in New Hampshire and in Iowa. I actually talked to Marco Rubio a couple days ago about corporations that are cashing in on missile production. So we're going to be able to talk to these folks and try to raise this issue about what we call governing under the influence, or companies like GEO, like Lockheed, like CCA, that are using their lobbying, using their campaign contributions, using this revolving door of influence peddling to get what they want, which is basically money for government contracts, not in the public interest, and try to put that issue squarely in the center of the political dialogue going into the 2016 presidential race. And we'd love for your listeners to help us out by giving us ideas, or it's certainly some of these people are from your states, or they might be coming around to your states at some point too. So you can join in, use your social media accounts, use other ways of raising these issues, so that we can change the dialogue in order to actually win the debate.
Absolutely, and we only got a couple more minutes with you, but I did want to ask you, as far as the situation, we have the IRP6 that's wrongly convicted, and we just want to get your thoughts on the fact of the IRP6 sitting there as basically innocent, but sitting in prison, as well as others that are wrongly convicted, and the amount of money that's wasted to house the innocents. Give us your thoughts on that quickly.
I don't know much about the IRP6 other than what I've just heard in the last hour. It sounds like an appalling situation, but sadly one that is not all that unusual. Some of the things I've been reading have been about the political motivations of the prosecutors having, in a sense, more to do with this situation than the judges or other aspects of the system. People who were elected politically we've got a situation right now in New Hampshire where we've got Republicans, people running for the state Senate, accusing other people running for the state Senate of being basically soft on killing cops because they want to get rid of the death penalty. I mean, this is just appalling. So it's politics as usual. is what's responsible for putting more people behind bars who shouldn't ought to be there, or putting people in prison for longer than they ought to be. And it's interesting, if you look at the internal documents of companies like GEO and CCA, you look at their Form 10-K, they have to file it every year with the Securities and Exchange Commission, they are very clear that they see sentencing reform, immigration reform, this type of thing as a threat to their business model. So if they've got lobbyists in Washington, their lobbyists are representing their interest, which is more jails, more people locked up for longer. And that goes along with this whole problem. So we've got a bunch of things to deal with, and I'm glad you're on the air every week stirring the pot so people keep this going.
All right, so Mr. Alper, how can you were talking about folks reaching out and getting involved,
yeah,
and so forth. So do you have a website or something where folks can join in the campaign? And I know, you know, everyone has to get involved, you know, at their own local level, but how can they get involved?
That's right. Well, the American Friends Service Committee has programs in a bunch of cities across the United States that are working both on these issues of prisons and issues of immigration, plus the stuff we're doing now in Iowa and New Hampshire. So if people go to afsc.org, we've got an office right there in Denver, people can find a way to get involved. We can also, if you go to afsc.org/influence, you'll find our Governing Under the Influence Presidential Campaign Project. You can also look for our program if you go to the website and look for where we work. That might be the easiest way. Just look for New Hampshire, and you'll find your way to me. People can email at afscnh@afsc.org. A is in American, F is in Friends, S is in Service, C is in Committee. I'd love to hear from people. And if your listeners have ideas on ways in which profit is infesting and infecting the prison system so that the profiteers are getting what they want through political influence, let us know those stories, those examples. We'll try to find ways to raise it when the presidential candidates come around in New Hampshire and Iowa.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Arnie Alpert with American Friends Services Service Committee. And we'll have information posted out on our website at ajcradio.com. So if you missed that, you can go out there and get more information on how to reach out to Arnie Alpert. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to go to the profile of the wrongfully convicted, and we'll be right back. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. At the inception of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. After many interviews, we discovered that many of the stories we outlined didn't quite fit the term exoneree or exonerated. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. Release conveys to free from confinement, bondage, obligation, or pain, to free from anything that restrains. The spirit of the exoneree moment lives on, to tell the personal stories of those whose lives have been devastated by the justice system, but we've renamed the segment to A Profile of the Wrongly Convicted. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The Profile of a Wrongly Convicted.
In 1983, 19-year-old Andre Davis from Chicago was sentenced to 80 years in prison for the murder and rape of a 3-year-old girl, a crime he swore he did not commit. The child was found next door at the Tuckers' home where Davis just visited that day. Davis was arrested after a friend of the Tuckers, Donald DeRoe, told police Davis told him he killed a white woman at the residence. After two trials where DeRoe and the Tuckers testified against him, he was convicted. At age 50, DNA concluded Davis was innocent and was released July 6, 2012. The DNA samples at the crime scene matched Maurice Tucker's genetic profile, but prosecutors claimed DNA evidence was not enough to charge him. While I'm happy to be free with my innocence established by the courts, I feel that those who were responsible for robbing me of the best years of my life should be held legally responsible for doing me so terribly wrong. He filed a wrongful conviction suit at the U.S. District Court. This has been a profile of the wrongfully convicted with AJC Radio.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. For more information about a Just Cause, go to www.a-justcause.com. And we also ask that you click on the donate button. We could always use help there. And then for archives of the program, go to ajcradio.com. And you can get go back and listen to a lot of the interesting programming that we've had on. And then also for 24/7 AJC IRP updates, you can go to live365.com. And then every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, you can catch us on Progressive Radio Network. You can get us by going to prn.fm. Again, that's on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. And then we just launched a partnership with the 405radio.com, so you can go out to the 405. And so we like to give you a lot of options. And so you can get all the updates on the IRP6. And, again, remember, you can go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. The IRP6 are David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. Keep them all in your prayers. So, you know, that was some good information that, as far as Mr. Alpert was concerned. If we jump back to the IRP6 and looking at, you know, some of the situations with that case, and I know we were, before the break, we were talking about the employment situation and how they were blackballed. And you know, Cliff, one of the things that came out during trial where Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch tried to paint the guys as though they did not have the goods, like they did not have the experience, did not have the experience base to do what they were doing. Yet, as we've talked about on several occasions, these men were highly skilled, highly sought after consultants in the market.
Absolutely. I mean, and we had the caller earlier, Tanique, who worked as a recruiter for some of these Fortune 500 companies. She alluded to the fact that, you know, hey, these guys, you know, can make anywhere, you know, upwards of $100 an hour. When you have these type of consultants, see, that's the one thing where, you know, Judge Sarikin in one of his articles said, why would these men that can make this type of money, why would they stop doing that to go get less money to, you know, for lack of a better phrase, chase their dream if they're running a fraud, if they're running a scam?
Absolutely.
It's like, okay, let's all quit making our good money as consultants, that this is where we were making our livelihood. This is our career. This is what we've been doing for 15, 20 years. And let's go run a scam? That makes absolutely no sense.
It makes no sense.
And then when you add on top of that, you say, okay, how do you have a scam when you go in debt to produce, market, and sell a product?
you have a product where you're saying we're developing this product. We're going in debt to develop it because we have a potential client in Department of Homeland Security where you're talking about, you know, the largest law enforcement agency in the country that was brought about to consolidate all of law enforcement on the federal level. How do you call that a scam? That is so outside of the realms of just common sense that, oh, they got to be running a scam. And for whatever reason or not that the prosecutor would come up with this type of foolishness, it's like these men, you're talking about software architects, you're talking about database architects, you're talking about system engineers, you're talking about network cybersecurity specialists, and they just dropped their jobs to go run a scam to not make. I mean, the money didn't the money where the IRP6 went into debt. This isn't money that went through their hands, that went into their pockets.
That's right.
This is money that was paid to the staffing company's employees. As you said earlier, Sam, you know, they went out, they had to get these staffing companies to find employees that had the particular skill sets to help them create this the Silk software. Now, you're talking about software that had to be secure from a federal government level. You're talking about software that had to be able to run under very harsh conditions, meaning the user load. I mean, you're talking about DHS has thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of agents that this software would have to be running the same time while all these agents are using it. This is the type of work that these men specialize in, and these were the type of people that they were looking for these staffing companies to provide that knew how to develop like this. So you're not going to – sometimes people ask us, well, hey, why did they have all these staffing companies? Why couldn't they just use one? You're not talking about they were looking for, you know, telemarketers. And nothing against telemarketers. You know, I was a telemarketer for 5 years. But you're not – the price that I charge, the hourly rate I charge and what I do now, that's not what I got paid as a telemarketer. Telemarketer, I was making minimum wage or maybe a few pennies more. But the staffing company that I work with as a telemarketer is not the same staffing company that I work with now when they place me in my IT role. So, yeah, you have to use several different companies to say this is the particular individual that I'm looking for. I'm looking for an individual with a particular set of skills that knows how to do this job, that knows how to do system security, that knows how to do network engineering and database development and database engineering and administration. These individuals are not just out there, you know, that you go into today's staffing and they're sitting in the lobby waiting for somebody to give them a day job. That's not the way it works.
And Cliff, you know, when you're talking about the number of staffing companies that IT companies use, you know, for those who are in the IT industry, who are consultants, who are contractors and make a living doing that, they will know that you know, especially Fortune 500, Fortune 100 companies, they have what they call, what is it, like a preferred vendor list or a premier vendor list or something to that effect. And that list can have, it may have a primary or a couple of primary staffing companies on there, but then underneath there, they're going to have a lot of other staffing companies. Anybody I mean, you can go out there, and I would invite our listeners even right now, go on monster.com or Dice would be probably a good one, dice.com, and do a job search on anything IT related.
Right.
And you will see a lot of companies that will pop up. And in a lot of situations, one company will have, let's say, openings for 10 positions.
Right.
Where there are going to be 300, 400, 500 companies out there trying to place those 10 positions.
Exactly. And I just got some information from the research team. You look at a company like Jabil. Jabil is a worldwide, you know, basically like a hardware circuit board telecom company.
Right.
Per se, that's one of their arms. Now, Jabil has 150 staffing vendors that they work with.
150.
So 150. That's how many staffing companies they with. Comcast has over 100.
Let's not plug them.
But
well, yeah, let's use that.
It's like, okay, Comcast has over 100 staffing companies that they use. So you have these companies that say, yeah, we have these companies on our vendor list.
Right.
Because one staffing company cannot provide everybody
cannot.
That we look for. We have people in the call center. That may be one company.
Yep.
We have people in the IT department. That may be 10 more companies.
That's right.
We have people who do hardware repair. That might be some other companies. These staffing companies specialize in certain areas. And so that is why.
Project management,
right,
testing.
Everything that goes, the amount of different skill sets
that
go into the what they call the software development lifecycle.
Yep.
I mean, you got everybody from a receptionist, a project coordinator, a project manager, a program manager. You have software developers. You have configuration managers. You have system administrators, system engineers. You have business analysts, system analysts. You have this whole spectrum of these different professionals that go into developing a project. And like I said, when you have something as big as we are providing a product for the federal government, for Department of Homeland Security, it's nothing to have the amount of staff and agencies that IRP Solutions utilize to help build the Silk software.
And you cannot – I mean, when you're looking at, like, IRP Solutions, and they're going up against Fortune 500 companies, you know, for this type of business. And like you were saying, you know, the Department of Homeland Security bringing under its umbrella all these other federal agencies. And at the time, the Department of Homeland Security was a new agency,
right,
had deep pockets. And the FBI, DOJ had serious problems with failed initiatives.
Yes.
But, you know, in the fall of 2004, IRP Solutions was invited to come to an industry day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where DOJ and Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, they put on kind of a show to tell all of the major defense contractors, here's what we need from you guys. Well, what they showed was the same things that IRP had showed them.
Right. And this is a company that sees the promise of success on the horizon. And I mentioned, you know, Judge Sarikin's article a few minutes ago, and here's one of the comments from his article. He says, basically, the defendants were convicted of contracting with staffing companies to hire and pay contract employees to work on a software project intended to be sold to law enforcement. The government contended they never intended to pay, and the software was a scam. But one has to ask, what did they gain by having people paid for work? And if you were scamming, would you pick out law enforcement as the target? They didn't get the money. The workers did. They just owed it and were late in paying. Now, this comes from Judge Sarikin after he does his research, looks over the transcripts, looks over everything that we sent him after, you know, Sam, he grilled me and you for hours over several days that, you know, you need to give me the information I'm looking for. And if I find out that you guys are trying to play games, for lack of a better phrase, I'm just going to walk away from it. Well, with the information that we gave him and the transcripts, he found these are the things that he came to this was his conclusion.
Yep.
And
yep.
Then he also says the government claims that the staffing companies were engaged with no intent, that the defendants engaged the staffing companies with no intention to pay them, the intent necessary to make it a crime. If the defendant's program was a scam, as the government contended, then what would be the purpose of hiring staffing companies? How would the defendants benefit by actually doing the work on a project if it were indeed a scam? The government claims defendants receive free labor, but how would they benefit from it if they never intended to sell the product? The staffing companies paid the employees, not the defendants. The element of criminal intent is totally lacking. And how do you have a crime if there is never an intent? How do you have a conspiracy if there's never an intent to commit a crime? The intent was to produce, to market, and to sell a product, just like anybody else goes into business, just like any other business model is, we're going to produce a product, we're going to model that product, we're going to market that product, and then we're going to sell that product for profit and to be able to pay off our debt. It's the same situation with the IRP6. The government is the one who came in and put a stop to everything that they were doing. All of their – every – you know, leeway, everything that they had worked toward, every milestone that they had made, everything good that had happened, every potential client that had been in touch with. I mean, DHS contacted IRP Solutions.
Yep.
And for the government to go in and say, don't have any more communications with IRP Solutions, they're under investigation. And with DHS being another arm of law enforcement of the federal government, when the FBI says, don't do it, it's like, okay, we're not going to interfere with your investigation. We'll basically put the brakes on. And with that, it totally was an interference in commerce with against IRP Solutions, because now you've told their biggest potential client that they had a quote in for $100 million that you can't do business with them. Go ahead, Lisa. You had a comment.
And Cliff, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the beginning of the trial, didn't David Banks, one of the IRP 6, request to have it made clear to the jury what intent actually entailed, so that the jury would understand what actual intent is? Because without intent, then you cannot
there
say
there is no crime.
You cannot say that they committed a crime if they they never intended to do anything wrong, because the basis of the charges against them rested on what they intended to do. And the judge, Christine Arguello, denied to let the jury even be informed of what intent is, of what that actually means, to get a clear understanding of what it means, what the actual intent is, and how important that was for this case.
Absolutely. And Lamont, I know you have a comment, but real quick, the craziest thing about that, Lisa, is the reason Judge Arguello said that she denied them being able to explain what their intent was, or the definition of criminal intent. She said that defining that, clearing that up, would confuse the jury.
Oh, how full of crap.
You never the definition of a word, of a phrase, of a ideology does not bring confusion.
That's
to
right.
It. When you define something, that clears it up. If
brings
I have
clarity.
A word called supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, now what does that mean? Nobody knows. But if I define that,
Mary
that's
going to
confuse
right,
you.
And,
yeah.
And if I define that and lay it out and say, this is just a word made up by Mary Poppins,
yep.
It is just a word that's used when you say, there's something I have no idea what's going on
yep.
here. I use that as to explain that. Then you say that confuses the whole situation. Lamont, you had a comment?
Well, what's crazy about this is that during the course of my trial, the judge made it clear when he advised me of the charges against me. His statement to me was that the people are accusing you, or the charges against you, that you knowingly, with knowledge and full knowledge and knowingly, went in and set out to commit this crime.
Right.
That you knowingly enough, there's another word for it, I don't remember the second word, but that you knowingly went in and done this. Intent is in every trial, every courtroom. Intent is brought into question because it changes the entire case. It changes the entire sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
It changes the entire charge. If I, with intent, went in and committed this crime, then my penalty is far greater.
Right.
If say a crime happened, but it was not my intent to do so, if I didn't intend, say a man accidentally gets in a struggle with another man, he accidentally hits his head on the counter and ends up dying. Well, the prosecution must prove what my intent was.
Yep.
Yep.
And you know, Lamont, when you look at the definition of criminal intent, and I don't care where you look, you can look at different definitions on different websites, different law dictionaries, and it always comes down to that it's something that involves a conscious decision.
Absolutely.
To deprive another.
Mm-hmm.
Or to your – it's a conscious decision to injure another.
Right.
And so it's like there. If you don't sit down and you just – like you said earlier, Cliff, it's stupid. And like Judge Sarkin said, why would someone sit down – and, quote, devise a scheme,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to cost you in the sense of, okay, I'm going to purposely not make more money so that I can devise the scheme.
Right.
Well, and you're doing it with law enforcement, and you got law enforcement in the building every day. You got retired federal agents working in your building. You got a retired judge and a college professor working in your building.
And your client, your
client
this.
Is the largest
right.
federal law enforcement agency in the country.
Well, no jury is going to convict you if a witness is allowed to testify, which this expert witness would have been allowed to.
Right.
There was a hearing of some sort that approved him as an expert witness. Number one, you can't go back and rewind and do a mulligan. You've already approved this witness to come in and do what to say. He's already been cleared as an expert witness. The difference is there's not a jury that sits there. And my understanding is I can guarantee you any jury wants to know. And again, if it's presented to them that the RP6 had no intent, they had no motive.
Right.
Intent and motive go hand in hand.
That's right.
Yeah. So if I had no motive, then I have no intent.
Yes.
No motive.
Yeah. Where is the criminal intent? Without that, you have no crime. Your intent is your premeditation to commit a crime. Without that, then there is no crime.
So we premeditated to contact the FBI, to hire FBI people. We had an intent to hire law enforcement to defraud these people. And matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, the FBI folks that were working with IRP, wasn't some of those folks specialists in fraud?
They sure were.
Are you kidding me?
No, we're not kidding.
Hey, and Lamont, they were actually referred to IRP Solutions by other federal law enforcement agencies. And then when you look at the fraud, you know, the alleged fraud aspect of this, Cliff, I mean, you were talking earlier about the money, you know, the money not going to IRP Solutions. And then you got to look at the product. On the money side, even during trial, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, they put on the stand a federal forensics financial analyst who showed that the money trail did not lead back to the IRP 6. How can a jury convict on that?
The prosecution showed that?
Yes. Yes. Wow. And then from the software side, you got Cal Forensics, who this is a software forensics analyst, and Don Vilfer. He was what, Cliff? He was a retired federal agent.
Retired federal agent, an attorney, a forensics analyst,
a fraud expert.
Specialist.
Yes. And he analyzed the software, and he said, this software is real. It does what it's designed to do. It does what the IRP solution says it will do. But did the jury get a chance to hear that?
Absolutely not. Because, and that is what really gets you about this, is because every action that Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, every action that he requested against the defendants, Judge Arguelles was right there to accommodate him. Another part of, I believe this was in Sarakin's article, the research team just sent it, and it's an excerpt saying the relevance of IRP Solutions post-2005 activity denied in the government's motion in limine. So the U.S. government excludes from trial evidence occurring after February 2005, calling that evidence, this is just totally insane, calling that evidence irrelevant and alleging that evidence, I mean, the wording of this is insanity. The government alleged that evidence, not conjecture, not opinion, not some witness's testimony, but evidence could confuse, mislead, or prejudice the jury. How does evidence confuse anybody?
And the
jury asked for more evidence, and the judge says no. How does evidence confuse, mislead, or prejudice you? When you say somebody got shot, here's the gun right here. How do we know it's the gun? Because forensic evidence says that this bullet came out of the chamber and the barrel of this gun. We can track it back by the marketing, by the markings, and by everything that's inside the barrel of this gun. That's how we know the bullet came out of it. How can that confuse you as a jury? How does that mislead you? You're talking about evidence of what happened. Then it says
The government motion barred the defendants from presenting the status and capabilities of the software and the testing of the current version and the existence of a current market for the software. The government interfered with commerce and had that evidence suppressed to ensure the jury was not aware of that interference. The government covered up the marketability of the Silk software.
And one sale of that software, if you take Philadelphia, that in and of itself would have settled everything.
It would have settled every day.
And even just before the raid in the fall of 2004,
mm-hmm.
when the Department of Homeland Security asked IRP Solutions to give us a quote, if you will, on the confidential informant module, because that was something that was important to them.
Right.
It was something that the 9/11 Commission report talks about. IRP Solutions provided the Department of Homeland Security with $100 million quote.
Right.
Now, I don't care if you can't add, I don't care if you can't subtract, I don't care what the size of your checkbook is, that right there will settle any
that
debt that was.
And that was for one module. Of the software that
now out of
has,
18 modules.
Has 18 modules. But even without that sale, you still have the pilot project.
That's right.
That DHS said, hey, we can put the Silk software in this pilot project for, what was it, $19 million or something
or
like
or
that?
Or 10 or 12 or something
or
like that.
10 or 12 million, which still would have settled all the debt and gave IRP Solutions enough capital to continue working and continue building on the software. But the government ensured with their statement, you are not allowed to talk to IRP Solutions. They're under investigation.
And what was that date that they didn't want to go back? They would not allow them to talk about something past the raid date.
Right. They said anything after February 2005, you can't talk about anything after that.
Yeah.
And why? Because it showed it showed the crimes that the prosecutor committed in this case.
That's right.
It's like it was bad enough that on the day of the raid that John Smith, the special agent in charge that put on the raid, that he had an affidavit that was a lie saying, you know, this company they're not real. They're not real. They're not really producing software. They say they are, but they aren't. They're just a scam. Everything after that day is basically suppressed. And why Judge Arguello allowed that to happen? Well, we know why.
Well, I can tell you why
they
can't deal with that information. You have a judge who's trying to ensure that the jury is led down the road of conviction.
That's right.
She's trying to ensure that no matter what happens, the jury convicts these men.
That
was her goal, was to ensure that they're convicted. So if I allow this other evidence to come in, then they're going to see all these other things that went on. They're going to see all the corruption. They're going to see all these crooked things. And then they're not going to convict these men.
That's
and like
right.
you said earlier, Lisa, when you were talking about intent, then they, you know, anything, when you look at that February 2005 date, anything beyond there would have shown the intent was
yes.
to continue
right.
to market and sell the software to settle our debt.
Now, look
there
at this.
There was
let
no intent.
Look at this. Who could? We're doing fraud. Oh, my. We get caught by FBI to pull up the raid. Who stays in business and says, we're going to keep doing this same scam. We're just going to keep pushing. This is a company who says, I will prove to you that my product is viable.
That's right.
And that it is marketable, that I can sell it. And that would have happened if the government hadn't interfered. No company pulling off a scam when the government comes in and raids you stays in business. Those are the companies that totally disappear. And
yeah, they say, we got caught. We got to back
exactly.
up now.
Their executives jump on a yacht and disappear to 12 different islands.
That's if they had the money.
Right. If they had.
If they had the money. And the IRP6 didn't have the money.
Right, because there was no scam fraud because the money never went to them.
There was no money.
That's right.
It was debt.
It was debt.
There was no scam. Nobody was pocketing anything.
That's right.
And so it's like none of this adds. I mean, that's what Judge Sarikin says. That's what other people. It's like none of it adds up. It makes absolutely no sense. And when you look at, you know, like you were saying, Lisa, it's like from day one. Raid, February 9th, 2005, John Smith walking in the door with a warrant in his hand. They got the judge to sign off and saying that this company is purportedly developing software.
Yep.
From day one, all the way down to October 2011 when the conviction.
Yep.
Yeah. And you know, when AJC went out and did research and shared some of the evidence that wasn't allowed during the trial, shared some of that with the jurors, some of these jurors said that if they had seen that evidence, it would have been a different outcome, that they would have made a different decision. They would have come back with a different verdict if they would have had that information in front of them. And that right there tells you that what the judge did, what the prosecutor did, was ensure, the judge ensured that the prosecutor, like Lisa said, pushed the jurors down a particular road to ensure that a conviction came back. And it is atrocious that a federal judge would stoop to this level to help out a prosecutor to ensure that innocent people go to jail. So the jurors, if you want any more information, if you want some of the background research and some of this evidence that we have that you haven't seen, give us a call. We're at 855-529-4252 or send us an email at contact@a-justcause.com and we'll give you any information we have.
Hey, Cliff, you're talking about a judge that would stoop to certain levels to ensure that there's a conviction. Well, Judge Arguello would even stoop to the level of violating their Fifth Amendment rights and then making the transcript disappear. Lisa.
Yes, we want, and what we want everybody to do, as many people as possible, and we want you to call Eric Holder's office. I didn't mention that at the beginning of the show, usually do. We want you to get on the phone, call Eric Holder's office at 202-514-2003 or 2005. We need them to investigate this case and find and force them to release the missing sidebar of this case that shows violation of these men's Fifth Amendment rights. It could exonerate these men and move us forward. We need your help. We can't do it without you.
And also, we'd like to also remind you to keep the IRP 6 in your prayers. David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. If you'd like more information on the IRP 6, go to freetheirp6.org. You can also go to ajcradio.com, live365.com. Catch us on Sunday mornings, 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Progressive Radio Network. Cliff.
Yeah. Say thank you to our guest, Arnie Alpert. Appreciate you spending some of your time this evening. Thank you to everyone who called in, all your comments. Thank you, everyone in the chat room, and the comments that you made there. Also, to our production team, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson, helping out Ill Skeleton Girl in the control room. Without them, you would not hear what it is we have to say. To our production support team, they give us accurate and up-to-date information that we can deliver to you and to the truth. We know you out there. And we appreciate it.
And a shout-out to a couple of other folks who are very supportive of the IRP 6 as well as the Just Cause. Number one, Judge H.B. Honorable Judge H. Lee Sarikin, and we've referred to his articles. You can go out onto Huffington Post and do a search on Sarikin. That's S-A-R-O-K-I-N. You will be astonished by what you will read. Be sure to tune in each Tuesday and Thursday right here on A Just Cause Coast to Coast from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a lineup for you on Thursday night where we're going to bring you more information and expose more things about the IRP 6 case. You don't want to miss that because, you know, it's just things that happen in the judicial system that if you're not involved in it, you wouldn't believe it. But we're going to make you believe it, and you got to get it right here. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Cliff, did you have something else you needed to add?
Just good night to y'all.
But we didn't thank Olivia, Gloria, and who else?
Miss
Barbara. Thank you guys so much for all your hard work behind the scenes. We love you. Thank you so much.
All right. Good night, America. We'll talk to you next time.